right, this evening will be in Numbers 1 and 2. I want to begin, though, if you would, turn with me to Genesis 15. Bit of a reset tonight. The early portions of Numbers, as we talked about last time, specifically the first 12 chapters or so, the Israelites are beginning at Mount Sinai. It's about 1 month after the tabernacle has been erected. They have already entered into covenant with Yahweh, and they have agreed to the Book of the Covenant, which we read in Exodus 20 through 23, and they are beginning in Sinai, and they will be on their way to the land of Canaan. And the reason they are at Sinai is because God has delivered them out of Egyptian slavery. And the reason they are on their way to the land of Canaan is because God has made a promise. He made a promise to Abraham all the way back in Genesis 15, very important chapter. We will not spend a lot of time there this evening. You can go back and look at that in the Genesis study. But there are a couple of things in Genesis 15 that I want you to be reminded of. Verse 1, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, Abram, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." And Abram said, "O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" And Abram said, "Since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir." Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This man will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir." Verse 5, "And he," God, "took him," Abram, "outside and said, 'Now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your descendants be.'" And so the first promise that God makes to Abram here in Genesis 15 is that Abram would have descendants that are of the number of the stars. If you turn over a little bit, we'll skip down to verse 12 in this covenant that God is making here with Abram. Verse 12, "Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete.' And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark. And behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces, the pieces of the animals that had been cut. Verse 18, "On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite.'" This second great promise here in Genesis 15 that God makes to Abram is that his descendants would inherit the land of Canaan. And so that's where we are, actually, at the beginning of Numbers. We will discuss tonight in Genesis chapter 1 the census that Moses takes of the Israelites who have come out of Egypt. And we will see that that is a near-term, certainly, fulfillment of the descendants of Abraham being numbered as the number of the stars. And then, of course, they are on their way to Canaan. They are on their way to Canaan to take the land of Canaan that God had promised to Abram. So that is where we begin. We are on our way to Canaan, and we will count the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In Numbers chapter 1, I'm going to read a bit here. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel. You and Aaron shall number them by their armies. With you, moreover, there shall be a man of each tribe, each one head of his father's household. These then are the names of the men who shall stand with you, of Reuben, Elizur, the son of Shedur, and of Simeon, Shelumiel, the son of Zerishaddai, of Judah, Nashon, son of Amminadab, of Issachar, Nethanel, the son of Zuar, of Zebulun, Eliab, son of Helon, of the sons of Joseph, of Ephraim, Elishama, the son of Ammihud, of Manasseh, Gamaliel, son of Pedazur, of Benjamin, Abidan, the son of Gideoni, of Dan, Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai, of Asher, Pagiel, the son of Ochran, of Gad, Eliasaph, the son of Duel, of Naphtali, Ahira, the son of Enan. These are they who were called of the congregation, the leaders of their fathers' tribes. They were the heads of divisions of Israel. So Moses and Aaron took these men who had been designated by name, and they assembled all the congregation together on the first of the second month. Then they registered by ancestry in their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, head by head, just as the Lord Yahweh had commanded Moses. So he numbered them in the wilderness of Sinai. And I'll read 20 and 21 only. Now the sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, head by head, every male from 20 years upward, old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Reuben were 46,500. All right, so I'm not going to read the rest of the census. The language in verses 20 and 21 is repeated again and again, 12 times, to provide the numbers for each of the 12 tribes of Israel, not counting Levi. And remember, there are 12 because Joseph has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and they are both counted. This census, according to verse 1, is taking place 1 month okay, after Exodus 40. So it's the first of the second month. So Exodus 40 is the erection of the tabernacle and God's indwelling of the tabernacle. That happens at the beginning of the first month of the second year. And so here we are 1 month later. And Moses is commanded to take a census of the Israelites, of all the males 20 years old and upward, verse 3, whoever is able to go out to war. And so they are literally preparing for war in the land of Canaan. Again, fast forward, I'm sure I'm not ruining the end for you, but eventually the Israelites will go west across the Jordan River into the land of Canaan under the leadership of Joshua, and there they will take control of Canaan per the promise that God made to Abram all the way back in Genesis chapter 15. And so this census is to count the number of males who are ready for war, age 20 and up. And of course, in verses 5 through 15, each of the tribes, there's identified a leader of that tribe, okay, the person who is responsible for performing the census and reporting the numbers. And so we see here in verse 21, the number for Reuben, 46,500. In verse 23, the number for the tribe of Simeon, 59,300. In verse 25, number for the tribe of Gad, 45,650, which is actually a very interesting number since it doesn't end in double zero. We're going to circle back to these numbers at the end this evening, Lord willing. So I'm just going to rattle them off now. Verse 27, the number for the tribe of Judah, 74,600, which is a very large number relative to the rest of them. Verse 29, for the tribe of Issachar, 54,400. Verse 31, the tribe of Zebulun, 57,400. Verse 33, for the tribe of Ephraim, 40,500. For the tribe of Manasseh, 32,200 in verse 35. For the tribe of Benjamin, in verse 37, is 35,400. Verse 39, the tribe of Dan, 62,700. Verse 41, for the tribe of Asher, 41,500. Verse 43, the tribe of Naphtali, 53,400. And so when you sum those up, verse 44, these are the ones who were numbered, whom Moses and Aaron numbered with the leaders of Israel, 12 men, each of whom was of his father's household. So all the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their father's households from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war in Israel, even all the numbered men were 603,550. And you can see this is not the first time that this number appears. It appears back in Exodus as well. So there's no real surprise here. But again, they are preparing for war. In verses 47 and following, here we have the Levites, however, were not numbered among them by their father's tribe. For the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, "Only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor shall you take their census among the sons of Israel. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall take care of it. They shall also camp around the tabernacle. So when the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle encamps, the Levites shall set it up. But the layman who comes near shall be put to death. And the sons of Israel shall camp, each man by his own camp, and each man by his own standard, according to their armies. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the sons of Israel. So the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle of the testimony. Thus the sons of Israel did, according to all which the Lord had commanded Moses. So they did." I'm not going to talk a lot tonight about the tribe of the Levites for the reason that when we gather together next week, Lord willing, we will be discussing Numbers chapters 3 and 4, which goes into great detail about the tribe of the Levites, their responsibilities, the numbers in the Levite tribe, and so on and so forth. So I'm not going to talk about them extensively this evening. But what we are going to see here in Numbers chapter 2 is we're going to see the arrangement of these tribes around the tabernacle. So as the Israelites are living in and traveling through the wilderness under the guidance of Yahweh, when Yahweh moves, the whole camp moves. And so when they are camping there in their tents, they are commanded here in Numbers chapter 2 to be arranged around the tabernacle in a certain order according to the Lord's wisdom. Let's see that here in Numbers chapter 2, verse 1. "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, 'The sons of Israel shall camp, each by his own standard, with the banners of their fathers' households. They shall camp around the tent of meeting at a distance.'" And so what we see here, as we get ready to sort of read through Numbers chapter 2 here, is something that we talked about extensively in the study in Leviticus, and that is that Yahweh is going to live in literally in the midst of his people. The tabernacle, or the tent of testimony, it goes by several names, the tent of meeting, it will literally be in the center of the camp, and there will be three tribes on each side of the tabernacle, so that God himself will be living in the midst of the camp. And although it's not discussed here, I'm going to go back and make sure we understand this concept of being taken out into the outer darkness. The outer darkness is the place outside of the camp, right? Not only do you have the presence of Yahweh by the pillar of fire in the tabernacle, but you also, I assume, have fires in the camp, right? I mean, they're living out in the wilderness, and so for heat or whatever. And so you have this camp where there is light, where there are people living, and the outer darkness is outside of there. And so, for example, that would be relevant in the case of the Day of Atonement in Leviticus chapter 16, when the scapegoat is ushered outside of the camp. And that would be figuratively speaking into the outer darkness, but literally speaking outside of the presence of God, taken away from the presence of God and his people. So Yahweh here, as he's arranging the camps in Numbers chapter 2, he is literally identifying himself in the midst of his people. Numbers chapter 2, verse 3. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be of the standard of the camp of Judah by their armies, and the leader of the sons of Judah, Nashon the son of Amminadab and his army, even their numbered men, 74,600. And those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Issachar, and the leader of the sons of Issachar, Nethanel the son of Zuar, and his army, even their numbered men, 54,400. Then comes the tribe of Zebulun, and the leader of the sons of Zebulun, Eliab, son of Helon, and his army, even his numbered men, 57,400. Verse 9, the total of the numbered men of the camp of Judah, 186,400 by their armies. They shall set out first. So this is the pattern that we see. We're going to see it four times here in Numbers chapter 2. So on the east side of the tabernacle, please note that in verse 3, on the east side of the tabernacle, toward the sunrise, that will be the camp of Judah. All right, the camp of Judah. So there's a few things that you should note here. Number one is that the east side of the camp is the preferred side of the camp. It is the side of honor. And why is that? Well, the reason that is because that is the direction in which the tabernacle opens. That is the entrance into the way of the presence of God. You travel from the east to the west to go to God. And so this is the place of preeminence, and it is referred to in verse 9 as the camp of Judah. Even though Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun are there, this is the camp of Judah. And so what we see here is a couple of things. So first of all, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, they are all sons of Jacob's wife Leah. All right, so these are all in some ways more closely related than the other tribes. They're all sons of Leah. And the reason why Judah is given the place of preeminence, Judah's camp is given the place of preeminence, if you would turn back with me, I want to remind you, Genesis 49. Genesis 49. In Genesis 49 is where Jacob, who is Israel, the man, is blessing his sons in advance of his death. Genesis chapter 49. Now Judah is the firstborn of Jacob and Leah. So if you remember, Reuben was the firstborn, Simeon was the secondborn, Levi was the thirdborn, and Judah was the fourthborn. In Genesis chapter 49, verse 8, Judah gets the cream of the blessing. Okay? Judah gets the cream of Jacob's blessing. Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk. This is the highest blessing that Jacob gives to any of his sons. And the reason for that, which we discussed back in the Genesis study, was that Reuben had slept with his father's concubine and so forfeited his primary son's blessing. And Simeon and Levi, they were the ones, the sons of Jacob, who went in and they caused Jacob a very great deal of grief in the episode with Shechem in the rape of Dinah. And so Jacob reserves his highest blessing for his fourthborn son, Judah. And of course, as we tie that to the New Testament, that points us forward to the kingship of Christ himself, who was born as a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Judah. Okay? And so clearly we see here again in Numbers chapter 2, Judah with the place of preeminence on the east side of the tabernacle. And a very significant number, 186,400 in their camp. And when the tabernacle, when God decides to move the Israelites, this is the camp that goes ahead of everyone else, right? Again, the place of preeminence at the head of Israel's armies. In verse 10, there are the three tribes on the south side of the tabernacle. Those would be Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. Reuben, Simeon, and Gad are all related in the following way. Reuben and Simeon, as I previously mentioned, are sons of Jacob and Leah. And Gad is actually the son of Zilpah, who is Leah's maid. And so there's a relationship there between Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. And I want to note in verse 14, I'm not sure what your translation says, the one that you are holding, but in verse 14 it says, "Then comes the tribe of Gad, and the leader of the sons of Gad, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel." I'm going to come back to that at the end of the teaching, so I just wanted to note that there may be actually a text note there next to that name, Deuel. And so, verse 16, the south camp, the camp of Reuben, the number is 151,450, and they are to set out second as the Israelites move. They are to set out after the camp of Judah. Verse 17, "Then the tent of meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps, just as they camp, so they shall set out, every man in his place, by their standards." And so, although we're not going to discuss it at length this evening, if you have a study Bible in front of you, perhaps, or you do a search on the interweb for what the camps look like around the tabernacle, and in fact, I could share my screen just to give you a sense of what this looks like. This is, I believe, the picture from the ESV study Bible. And so you can see here the tent of meeting in the center, and you can see the camp of Judah with Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun on the east side of the tabernacle, and we just discussed the camp of Reuben down here on the south side of the tabernacle, and of course we'll get to the west side and the north side as well. But what you can also see here, which we will see next week as we discuss the tribe of the Levites, is that the Levites are to be encamped in between the common people and the tabernacle itself. And so when they set out to move, you can see here the direction of march in this particular case is left to right. You can see the camp of Judah goes first, then followed by the camp of Reuben, and then the tent of meeting, and the Levites will come in the center, which obviously provides them a significant amount of protection from the enemies by having Israelites and the army in front of them and in back of them. And of course, those would be followed by the camp of Ephraim and Dan. Okay, so that's where we are in verse 17, the Levites coming in the midst of the camps as they set out. Verse 18, we now move to the west side of the tabernacle, and these are Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. So this is the camp of Ephraim. And these three sons are related, right? They are, so Ephraim and Manasseh are the sons of Joseph, and Benjamin is Joseph's brother. And so there's a sense in which all three of these are sons of Rachel. So these are all related and so grouped together in a camp. And in verse 24, this camp on the west side of the tabernacle, or the backside of the tabernacle, if you will, 108,100 males, 20 and older. And then finally, beginning in verse 25, we have the north side of the tabernacle. We have the three remaining tribes, Dan and Asher and Naphtali. And Dan is the son, Dan and Naphtali are sons of Bilhah, which is Rachel's maid, and Asher is the son of Zilpah, who was Leah's maid. And in this, on the north side, the camp of Dan, 157,600. And they will set out last by their standard, verse 31. So verse 32, as we close out Numbers chapter 2, these are the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their fathers' households, the total of the numbered men of the camps by their armies, 603,550. The Levites, however, were not numbered among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they set out every one by his family according to his father's household. Okay, so here we have just the beginning stages. Numbers 2 ends on a very positive note. We see that early on here in Numbers, as God calls the Israelites to be counted, and so to set up their camps around the tabernacle, verse 34 of Numbers chapter 2, thus the sons of Israel did. And so we finish up with obedience on a good note. And, of course, that will change, as we know, as we head toward the land of Canaan, towards Numbers chapter 13. But for now, we are in a period of obedience of the Israelites. Now, last time we were together, after the recording went off, we talked a little bit about one of the challenges in reading and studying and interpreting the book of Numbers. And I mentioned after the recording went off that one of the biggest challenges with the book of Numbers is literally the numbers. And so I want to talk a little bit about the numbers in the census. I want to introduce that discussion, though, with something that I alluded to just a few minutes ago. So if you go back to Numbers chapter 2, verse 14, depending on your translation, you may have, at the end of verse 14, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, or you may have Eliasaph, the son of Reuel. Okay? Depending on your translation, you may have either one of those. If you would, turn back with me just one page, back to Numbers chapter 1, verse 14. Here you have the leader of the tribe of Gad, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, most likely is what yours reads. And so then the question is, why in some translation does Numbers 1:14 say Deuel and Numbers 2:14 say Reuel? Okay? And so I want to address that issue and use it to introduce some of the challenges associated with the numbers in this census. And the reason why some of you have Deuel in 1:14 and Reuel in 2:14 is because some of the manuscripts of the Hebrew Old Testament have different letters at the beginning of that name. It turns out that the Hebrew D as in dog, and the Hebrew R look very similar. They look very similar. And so when a scribe is making a copy of the Hebrew Old Testament, he might make a D look like an R, and then when that manuscript gets copied again, if it looks like an R, then the next scribe copies the R. Okay? This is a very small aspect of some of the challenges associated with what we call textual studies, or textual criticism, or manuscript studies. Okay? And it's a huge area of study that is ongoing. And it presents one of the challenges that we have as we study these ancient manuscripts. And some time ago in Sunday school, back before COVID life, we had an entire discussion on textual criticism and some of the challenges that we face when we look especially at New Testament manuscripts in the Greek language. The reason I say all that is to say this, is that there are a lot of challenges associated with the numbers that appear in the census that we find here in Numbers chapter 1. So I'm just going to walk you through some of those challenges to give you a sense of what the issues are. So first of all, and I think I alluded to this a little bit last week, there are people who say that coming up with 603,550 men age 20 and older after only 215 years of being in Egypt, starting with only 70 people, which is the number of people that came down from Canaan with Jacob into Egypt while Joseph was the vice regent there, that it's very difficult to get to 603,550 men age 20 and older. And if you just do some sort of reasonable estimate as to how many Israelites that would be in total, the number comes out to something between 2 and 3 million people. So the question is, can you go from 70 Israelites, essentially, Jacob and his family, to something like 2 to 3 million in a span of 215 years? And I did say last week, and I stand by what I said after the recording went off, is that yes, you can. It's actually not as difficult as some might think. I actually created a spreadsheet and ran through some of the numbers. And even with a relatively high death rate, which would have been evidence, say, of the last years that the Israelites were in Egypt under the very heavy hand of Pharaoh, it is not difficult to come up with a number like 2 to 3 million Israelites in Egypt, assuming God blessed them and protected them with something like 7 or maybe even 8 offspring per family. It's not difficult to do. You can change the numbers around. What is a generation? What is the average age of the childbearing age? What is the average lifespan of an Israelite? That sort of thing. It is not difficult. So it is not beyond the realm of reasonableness and possibility for that many people to come out of the 70 who came down into Egypt from Canaan. Okay, and in fact, if you go all the way back to Exodus chapter 1, verse 7, I would argue that the Bible actually speaks to this issue in Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty so that the land was filled with them. And so I would argue that the Bible itself bears testimony to significant growth of the nation of Israel while they are living in Goshen in the land of Egypt. Okay? So I don't think that's a huge challenge. That was challenge number one. Challenge number two. And again, some of these challenges will come through depending on what study Bible you're using in the introduction to the book of Numbers. Challenge number two is that there is no archaeological trace of the Israelites in the wilderness. Again, I do not think that this is a very difficult issue. So if you would turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 8, I think the Bible addresses this issue as well. Deuteronomy chapter 8. So Moses' farewell address, as it were. And Moses is speaking about God in Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 8, beginning in verse 3. And he, God, humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Verse 4, your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. And so it should not be surprising that there are no shoes or clothes left in the wilderness, because God bears testimony to his supernatural preservation of their shoes and their clothes, for example. And of course, God fed them with the manna every single day. So as far as I'm concerned, challenge number two is not a challenge at all. It's simply a challenge that's raised by those who are skeptics of the text itself. Not that big of a deal, frankly. Challenge number three. This one is, in fact, a bit of a challenge. And I was waiting. I was going to see if I should wait to discuss this next week, but I just decided to get it out of the way today. It happens to come in Numbers chapter 3. So we'll address it tonight and not talk about it next week. In Numbers chapter 3, verse 43. I'd say I'll pick up in verse 40 and then we'll read through 43. Then the Lord said to Moses, number every firstborn male of the sons of Israel from a month old and upward, and make a list of their names. And you shall take the Levites from me, I am the Lord, instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the cattle of the sons of Israel. So Moses numbered all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded him. Verse 43, and all the firstborn males by the number of names from a month old and upward, for their numbered men were 22,273. Now, this is a little bit more of a challenge, because if you do the simple math and you divide 603,550 by 22,273, you get a number that's around 27. And so what this tells you is that the ratio of the males in Israel to the firstborn males is something like 1 to 27, or 27 to 1. That is an incredibly high and, quite frankly, not believable number. Okay? And so then you have to deal with this particular challenge. Now, I think that although this challenge is a little bit more difficult than the first two, I think it is clearly not answerable, or it is clearly answerable in the following way. I believe that Numbers chapter 3, verse 43, is counting firstborn males up to the age of 20, from 1 month up to the age of 20, which would be the age of initiation of a person's own family and household. And here's the reason I believe that. If you would turn with me to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12 is the 10th plague. So it begins with the Passover lamb. Exodus chapter 12, I'll begin in verse 29. Now it came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. And Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians. And there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go. Worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go, and bless me also. And the reason why I think this particular text is relevant is because it is most likely that Pharaoh himself was a firstborn. And yet he did not die. And so there has to be some limitation on the number of firstborn who died as a result of the 10th plague. And so I see here that because God calls Moses to provide a census for those who are 20 years old and upward, the males, a reasonable limitation is that the number in Numbers chapter 3, verse 39, is the firstborn among those 1 month to 20 years of age, those who did not have their own households. Challenge number four. There are several biblical passages that assume and imply that the Israelite army and the nation of Israel was relatively small. So let me give you an example of that. If you would turn over with me to Deuteronomy 7. Deuteronomy 7. So in Deuteronomy 7, at least the first portion of it, there are warnings here for the nation of Israel, this new generation that is being called to go west across the Jordan and to go in and to take control of the land of Canaan. And in Deuteronomy 7, verse 7, Moses says this, "The Lord did not set his love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." And so this is one place. There are a couple of other places in Deuteronomy and even Joshua and Judges where the Bible implies that the nation Israel was relatively small, not relatively large. And make no mistake, if there were 2 to 3 million Israelites who came out of Egypt, that would be a very big number, and that would be a very big nation. Okay? Now, I do think here that one could easily look at Deuteronomy 7:7 and apply that to Joseph and his 12 sons. Right? So this may be a declaration that when God set his love on Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Israel the man, they were a very small clan at that time. God blessed them after the fact as they were slaves in Egypt. Nonetheless, some read these particular verses and raise them up as a challenge to the, quite frankly, large numbers that we find in the censuses in Numbers chapter 1 and 26. Challenge number five. With such a large army, what exactly were the Israelites afraid of in Numbers chapter 13? Again, 603,550 men prepared for war is a massive army compared to many armies in history. And so when we eventually get to Numbers chapter 13 and Moses sends the 12 spies into Canaan, and 10 of the 12 spies come out of Canaan and they are petrified of the Canaanite armies, regardless of their size, just in terms of sheer number, one could reasonably ask themselves, with 603,550 fighting men, what army on earth, or even group of armies, would they possibly have been afraid of? And challenge number six, we do have from history, both in the Bible and in extra-biblical literature, we have estimates of the inhabitants of Canaan, and those numbers are not as large as 2 to 3 million people. Okay? So those are six of the challenges that we have to think about as we are in Numbers chapter 1, and then we will see a similar census in Numbers chapter 26. So here's how I think we should think about this. And this, we can talk about it afterward. I'll stay on as long as we have to. But it's not clear to me that we need to understand these numbers as they're provided to us in the text. Here's what I mean. The Hebrew word for thousands can also mean clans or families, family groups. And it is my guesstimation at this point, as someone who has looked at textual critical issues in the past, okay? And the very small example of Duel and Ruel, I wanted to bring that out to you, and it just so happens that it falls right in the midst of the text we were studying tonight, to demonstrate that along the way, at some point, there may have been a transmission or an interpretation or a translation error in the Hebrew Old Testament that provides us with these very large numbers. Okay? I am not in any way, shape, or form speaking out against the infallibility of the scriptures. For example, the Chicago Statement on Inerrancy says that the Bible in its autographs is inerrant. Okay? But I need you to understand that the Hebrew texts that we have, that most of our Old Testaments are translated from, are dated to after the time of Christ. And when you go back to the Greek version of the Old Testament, which is the Septuagint actually has these very numbers in them, which tells me one of two possibilities. One is that these numbers are true and real, or the transmission, interpretation, and translation errors, if you will, happened before the Septuagint was created in the middle of the 3rd century BC, when the Hebrew scholars translated the Old Testament Hebrew into Greek at that time. Right? So, in essence, I'm actually not going to nail down a position on this particular issue. I think that the number of Israelites that God saved out of Egypt was large. Over 215 years, as God gave them growth and blessed them and kept them safe from the Egyptians, even under the heavy hand of Pharaoh, I believe that the Exodus was an incredible act of God to bring out his people from Egyptian slavery. And I believe there were many of them, because the numbers, if they are at all believable, that by the time Joshua takes the Israelite armies into Canaan, there are clearly at least tens of thousands of warriors in the Israelite army who take over Jericho and Ai and other cities like that. Whether or not the number is as large as 603,550, I confess that I have a little bit of doubt about the exactness of those numbers. If you have more questions about textual critical issues, I'm happy to answer those. But none of this is intended to cause anyone to question the veracity or the infallibility of the scriptures. Understand that this text that we're reading right now was written down 3,500 years ago. And these are the types of issues that we have to come through as we study the text. So again, God's saving work in the Exodus was a massive work. It was a glorious work. It points us forward to the freedom that we have in Jesus Christ and our salvation from sin. I just wanted to make you aware, and again, you can see these in a good study Bible, that the challenges associated with these numbers, and I think some of the challenges are at least worthy of being considered in terms of whether or not the numbers were that high. So when we pick up again next time, we will pick up in Numbers chapters 3 and 4 as we focus in on the tribe of Levi.